Charging right along.
This is Moses as a prophet. He starts off with an introduction of the qualities of prophecy for other prophets, and then he distinguishes Moses. And the difference is like a categorical difference. There's two categories. There's everybody else and Moses. Moses is a different category. And the passage which I have shown you on a number of occasions, different contexts, where Miriam and Aaron speak to Moses and they challenge him. And the essence of the challenge is, you separated from your wife. Why? Because you're a prophet? Well, we're prophets also. God spoke to us also. We didn't separate from our spouses. So what makes you so terrific or different, unique, that you have to separate from your spouse? So God invites Aaron and Miriam to a conference, so to speak, and says to them, how did you dare speak that way about Moses? Don't you know that he's absolutely unique? Other prophets I appeared to in a dream, in a vision, and unclarity. Moses is in a different category. He's clear and precise, and he's faithful in all my house. How did you dare speak against Moses? In other words, God is confirming that Moses' prophecy is different from the prophecy of all the others, and indeed, therefore, it was appropriate for Moses to separate from his wife due to the level of his prophecy. And Aaron and Miriam, who are both prophets, no, indeed, you could perfectly go ahead and put normal human living, because your prophecy is not the same level. That's the locus in the Torah where it says exclusively that Moses is unique. Now, Ramchal details the particulars. First of all, he says, other prophets, I speak to him in a vision or a dream. It doesn't mean that a dream or a vision are the same. There are two different ways that prophecy can reach a person. But dream or vision are different categorically from what Moses said. And he says, well, I told you previously that when he has prophecy, the other prophets, he loses consciousness. He's in a state similar to sleeping and dreaming. It can hit him when he's awake, but he like goes into a trance where he's not conscious of the world around him. It can be short or it can be long. For as long as the prophecy is there, he's in this disconnected state where the world around him is not interacting with him. And then, paragraph 4 talks about the lenses that we spoke about. The lens does distort or mask certain aspects of the vision, but as he says, the prophet understands the lens also. And therefore, as I told you, he can discount the distortions, and therefore he doesn't make any mistake about what it is that he's getting. Because the information in the vision is identified that he knows what it is that is true information in the vision, and what is the masking or distorting, which is hiding information from him. Moses, however, was on a totally different level. First of all, he didn't lose his senses or consciousness. Didn't come to him in a dream. He was wide awake in a normal state of consciousness. Now, I mean, this just sounds like words. How can I explain to you what this is like? Maybe go like this. You're standing at top of the Empire State Building. Not you, George. And somebody gives him a push. And he's now falling off the Empire State Building to his death. And I tell you, but his consciousness, his normal consciousness, he's not particularly excited. He's just counting the floors as he goes down, you know, calculating the acceleration of gravity, so that he find out the man, the force which pushes him at the ground. You know, it doesn't change. It's just, you know, calm and everything's going on naturally. That would be astonishing, right? I mean, it's falling to his death. You know, or imagine someone who we could hope to be As he's falling, he's saying Shema, and he's being careful about his pronunciation, make sure that, you know, that the ayin at the end of the Shema, Shema. And, you know, I've got 6 seconds to go. Okay, I'm going to get 6 seconds. And he thinks of the Kabbalists, you know, this is the Yudke Bavke, means the God is the creator of the universe. That's astonishing. I suspect that that's much less than what happened to Moses. He's having an experience that simply overwhelms everybody else, and he takes it standing up with normal conscience. Part of what I'm trying to tell you is, don't think that Moses could take this because it was stepped down. It was held back, you know, it was kind of weaker. No, this is the full thing, and he took it straight, which is an astonishing statement. And although he did have a lens, it was a single, highly polished lens, which had the least amount of distortion. Now, he talks here about mirrors and refraction and all sorts of things, which for a person trained in physics is a little funny, because mirrors don't refract, they reflect. None of this is exact. It's not really a mirror, it's not really a lens, it's not really a refraction, it's not really a reflection. It just means it's an intermediary so that not everything comes through perfectly clear. That's all that really is involved. Now, he quotes the phrase in the Torah, Usrulas Hashem Yavi, he gazes on, looks upon the picture of God. And of course, people get nervous. Picture of God. In the Hebrew, it is God's picture. Now think, is that ambiguous? Does that have two different meanings, God's picture?
Yeah. I mean, one is the picture of God, like you see God or whatever, or is a picture made by God?
Right. Or even possibly a picture owned by God, right? God's picture doesn't have to mean that it's a picture of God, that in the picture you have God's figure. That's not what the word has to mean. It can mean the picture that God made, or it can mean the picture that God owns. In Hebrew, it could mean all three, any one of the three. So Tmunas Hashem does not necessarily put us in a position where we're thinking that you can paint a picture of God. Kaplan translates a picture of God, but doesn't have to translate it. And of course, a picture of God is impossible. God can't, he has no physical form. Indeed, he says, coming up, that God has no form, and there's no picture of him. So the sense of it here, I believe, has to be, I think that's the sense of the Torah as well, has to be the picture that God made. God made a picture, and by looking at that picture, we can then learn something about what God does and how he does it. But it's not that it's a picture of him. It's sort of like, maybe, the score in music when you have, written music, sheet music, so you have all those blobs of ink with flags. I mean, some of them don't have flags, right? A lot of them do have flags. Now, I don't think that picture gives you a clue as to what it's a picture of. And somebody tells you, oh, sure, that's a picture of sound, see? I don't think you'd get much out of that. Only if you're a musician and you know how the picture is related to the sounds can you form an association. And even then, it's only a code. It's not a picture of the sounds. Do the shorter notes have bigger flags in sound? I don't think you'd guess that. You know, flags with more hairs on them, like a bee's wing or something. No. So here also, it's a picture that God makes, and from that picture, we can gain information about how God does, what God does. But more than that, it's not. Now, another thing, which is equally astonishing about Moses, is that he could have prophecy whenever he wanted it. He could command it. I mean, think of this in terms of a relationship. The creator of the universe gives to prophets this experience and this special information when the creator wants them to have it for one reason or another. Moses can sort of knock on the door and say, hey, God, I need something, and get it. So when certain people came to him and asked him a question, he said, wait a moment, and I'll get the answer from Hashem. You know, just wait a moment, I'll ring him up and give you an answer. It's astonishing. That's how close, and hope they see Nehemiah, who he's a trusted servant, and when he wants something, God is available to him on call, so to speak. Similarly, when God visited other prophets with prophecy, they got whatever specific communication was meant for them at that time. Moses could use prophecy to explore at will, to explore the secrets of God's universe, the secrets of God's creation at will. Call busy in heaven, faithful in all my house. I'll make all my goodness pass before you.
Did he attain all his secrets?
The whole basis. In other words, any secret that can be attained, he had.
He had it all for except for good and bad.
Well, I did put in a qualification. I said any secrets that can be had, he had. Correct. Which means, by the way, and I think there's some misunderstanding about this in certain quarters, that Moses' prophecy was greater than even that of the Messiah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a joke for some people. Some of them, but that's what I'm up to. Exclusively, Moses' prophecy was greater than anybody who was or will be, including the Messiah. It's a different category altogether. Moses' prophecy was the medium through which we got Torah, capital T. That will never happen again. Torah will never be given again. So what I'm saying now, I wanted to finish the chapter, but what I'm saying now is what I told you yesterday, what I'm telling you today, go hand in hand. Yesterday I told you that Moses' authority is greater than any other prophet. All later prophets lean on Moses for their certification as prophets, and the Messiah will also lean on Moses for his certification. We'll accept the Messiah as a prophet because Moses said to do so. That's his authority. Today we're learning about the quality of his prophecy, the quality of the experience, the quality of what he was given, what he got. The two things go hand in hand. It's because Moses was the prophet through whom Torah came to us that he has the unique quality of prophecy that he has. No new Torah is coming. That's it. This is the Torah once and for all. Not even the Messiah will bring in the Torah.
Did Moses have any prophecy about what will happen to him, that he would lose temper and he would not acknowledge God, and that incident?
No. Certain particulars at one time, let me try to make this clear. When we speak about Moses' prophecy, we're talking about his whole lifetime. He didn't get it all at once. Even the things, the secrets that he found them out one after another, and probably depended upon his interest at the time, what particular things he wanted to investigate. Now, as time went on, as you're saying quite rightly, there were certain things he didn't know. When the daughters of Sophia came to him and said, give us a portion in the land, he didn't know what to answer. When the people said, we are coming because we buried the two sons of Aaron who died, and we're worried about Pesach, we can't participate in the Paschal sacrifice, what can we do? Moses didn't know the answer right away. God had to tell him. So, obviously, certain things came to him as time went on. But, on the whole, he had access to whatever he wanted. I mean, he didn't know to want it because he didn't know that what was going
to
happen.
And it was up to Hashem to allow.
That's
right. Hashem probably wanted to.
He was not omniscient. He's not omniscient. There's a difference between a person who had access, unlimited access to information, and a person who knows all the information. You have an encyclopedia in front of you, so you can look at anything you want.
That doesn't mean you know it.
Right. It means it's there when you want it.
Right.
And if you don't know that there's a subject to be looked up, then you don't even know to look. Mm-hmm. My wife bought me recently an unbelievable sefer. It's called the Aspaclaria. That's the word that's used here for the lenses. It's 30 volumes on every Hashkafa subject that you could imagine. What this guy did, he's a doctor in Switzerland, what he did, I think he's a medical doctor. He just went through every Hashkafa subject and he copied out, this was done 28 years ago, I think the first edition came out, he was out of computers. He copied out from all the relevant sources, like 60 different sources, on every subject. It's astonishing. Any subject you want. From 60, starting with the Tanakh and the Zohar, and going all the way down to Mr. Miliot. Philosophy, Jewish philosophy. Whatever you want. It's an absolutely astonishing sefer. I'm just, sit down at the evening to take out something. There's 50 pages on Reuven, and 50 pages on Abraham, and Hashkafa, and Hashkafa, and Teva, and Nes, and whatever you want. Nature, miracle. Of course, it's all Hebrew, but it's a gold mine. Mine's a gold mine. But that doesn't mean, because I've got those 35 sitting on my shelf, that I know it all. It's just there, available, when I want to look something up. Okay, so as he says over here, chapter paragraph 7, that the prophecy means you know what you're getting, you know how you're getting it, you know why you're getting it, and you know to avoid mistakes about what you're getting. So that's why when the Jewish people were told, remember, at Sinai, you saw no image, it was only a voice. Twice it says there. You haven't seen any image. That God's true essence is not included in any image whatsoever. He's totally divorced from all possible visualization. So then when you do see a picture, you know it's not a picture of him, it's a picture from him, a picture that he created. A picture so that you can understand what's going on. But no more than that. It is true, by the way, in music, that when you look at the score, by looking at the score, you can hear it more in the music than you can otherwise. That's why, very often, if you want to understand a piece of music, buy a score, you listen to the recording, and you watch the notes dancing by. And you know what to listen for. Seeing the notes enables you to focus auditorily on what to listen for, otherwise you might miss it. In good performances, I can hear a piece that I've heard 100 times. What did I just hear? Yeah, Harold in Italy. I heard it on the radio, played by the Berlin Philharmonic. Now, I love that piece of music. I studied it years ago when I was in college. One of the pieces that we studied in symphony. I have a recording at home, and I listened to this one, and I heard things in that piece I've never heard before. It's unbelievable. I've heard it as many times as I've heard it. But no. So then when you look at the score, you get the same experience. Now, he mentions here something which is extremely important. So, it says twice, you saw no picture. Then there's a verse that says, they saw, referring to the elders, the God of Israel. So, here, obviously, you're not talking about seeing him. What we're talking about is seeing a picture that he produced in order to be able to understand something about it. That's how it has to be understood.
The voice.
Yeah, this. I was hoping you bring the pasuk. I think you bring the pasuk. The whole I'm rolling Mr. Kolos. Yeah, no, I don't need the pasuk. He doesn't bring the verse. He's bringing a supreme. I will say something about that. One verse about the revelation at Sinai says, "The whole I'm rolling Mr. Kolos." The whole people literally says, saw the voices. They saw the voices. And Chazal emphasized, Roi v'sanishma. They saw that which is heard. Now, what are we supposed to make of that? They saw the voices. I don't want you to be confused here. There is a condition, a neurological condition called synesthesia. In synesthesia, there's a kind of cross-wiring in the brain where a person will see certain colors or figures and that will trigger certain auditory experiences. So when he sees roses, he hears trumpets. And when he hears dogs, when he sees dogs, he hears saxophones. That's not what we're talking about. That's not what we're talking about. There, seeing a visual image causes an auditory experience. But what he hears is trumpets. Well, the sound of trumpets. What he hears is saxophones. The sound of saxophones.
You can hear something and see it.
Well, he sees one thing and hears something else. It's just that seeing one thing triggers the hearing of something else. So that's the kind of cross-wiring in the brain. And that's really something well understood. That's not what we're talking about here. Here it says they saw the voices. Not that they saw, not that they heard voices. They saw the voices. So if you look into your translation there, it says they perceived the voices. Ah, that's wonderful. In English, you have a word perceive. And perceive is broad enough to cover all the sensory modalities. You can perceive voices, you can perceive aromas, you can perceive tastes. Perceive is just all the sensory modalities. But in Hebrew, that's not what Liros means. Liros means to see. That's what Chazal pick at us and say.
Say you're saying it's wrong?
Sorry?
You're saying Rabbi Kaplan is wrong in the definition?
No, where is he being wrong?
No, it's that perceive, it's a different Hebrew word.
Which word, which are you talking about now?
It says, Marcia speaking of visualization, they call visualization as Jesus means the prophetic vision is not actually a depiction of God's glory, but a vision that others can see of each other.
Yeah, conceive is intellectual. Perceive is essential. But it says seen. Now,
It also says perceive. Mentioned earlier through which the vision is perceived.
Yeah, but perceive, that's okay. There's no problem here. My only problem with you can perceive a vision, you can see a vision. That's perfectly all right. I'm just saying that when you have the verb liros used together with voices, you have a problem. You really have a contradiction. Now, if a person then translates liros as perceive the voices, not the vision, here's a vision. Perceive the voices to avoid the contradiction, he's avoiding the contradiction. Taking the verb liros and using it a different way to avoid the contradiction. What's the truth here? I think the truth here is this. The Torah is using words. When I read those words, I know that in my life, in my experience, those words never apply. Never. Never. In my experience, would I have been tempted to say, oh yes, I saw the voices. That's just not there. It's just not part of my life. Now what happens when people use words that don't apply to your experience at all? So what you say is, well, they must have had a very different kind of experience. Something that I never experienced. Someone who used LSD told me once he experienced motion without changing place. Well, you don't have to be Einstein to figure out that something's wrong. Motion means moving from one place to another place. You can't move if you're staying in the same place. He said, I know, but those are the words that describe what I experienced. Okay. It's okay with me. Again, I'm inclined to say that never applied to me. I would never be moved to use those words to describe what's happening to me. So if something happened to him, that's quite different from anything that's happened to me. Here, seeing the voices is something which, it's just not part of my world. It's not part of my life. It's part of what happens to me. So when the Torah uses that expression, it's telling me something happened to them that's totally different from anything that happens to me. Now, I'm extracting something from a much longer presentation. I think that the way to look at it is this. At Sinai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to communicate, and did communicate, to an entire people a deep, subtle, philosophical idea. Up until that moment, things happened to them in the world. Okay, the world behaved in ways that are very peculiar and ways that are beyond normal, beyond natural. Crossing the Red Sea, the manna falling every morning, the pillar of fire, the pillar of cloud. These are clearly spectacular, spectacular events. Events unlike any other events that have happened at any other time. Good. Where is it coming from? Where is it coming from? Should we say that in the world there is a spectacular power, a power unlike any other that we've ever heard of, a power unlike any other that we've been able to understand or conceive? The world has in it things that we didn't dream of. And one of them is this power. Or should we say that this power is coming from something outside of our world altogether? How should we look at these events? How should we absorb them?
How should
we...
Is it not one and
the same? Sorry?
Is it not one and the same? Or was it that it's a force that happened to be the world? One and then the different? Yeah, but I mean, if it's not in your world, then it's not in your world. It could be in, you know, the physical, I mean, not the physical, because it's not really physical power, but if it's in your world...
You know, we discover new things that are in the world. Now, that doesn't mean that's the same as having to confront something that's outside of our world. Imagine the first person saw an elephant. First of all, they're very ugly. And second of all, they're very big. And they aren't, the trunk is unlike anything else in the world.
So you're saying it's like your 30 books that you just haven't, it's there, you just haven't seen it.
That's right. But the elephant walks and, you know, makes some noises and eats and sleeps and dies and is born. So it's another animal. You know, just weird, the weird animal. How could God communicate to an entire people? How many philosophers do you have in the entire people? Zero, maybe six or seven, you know. Most of just that weird stuff anyhow. He's not going to communicate to a whole nation the fact that he transcends the creation by virtue of giving them a lesson in Kant and Hegel and Hume and Hobbes and Montesquieu and Rousseau and the rest of those guys. How's he going to do it? If he's going to communicate it to a whole nation, he's got to do it through an experience. Only an experience will leave it as a possession of the nation as a whole. Now, your senses are designed to put you in contact with the physical world. That's what they're for. And that's why, when you hear a sound, you turn around to look. And when you see something, you put out your hand to touch. And when you come in contact with something, you turn your eyes to look. Because you know that the senses put you in contact with the world around you. That's why when you have a dream, you understand in the dream that it's an experience of a world around you. And in a lucid dream, where you're suddenly awake, what you have to tell yourself is, no, this isn't real. Because it comes to you as real. It comes to you as real. Your senses are designed to put you in contact with the world around you, and that's the way you experience them automatically. And if you know it isn't true for a particular occasion, you have to remind yourself that that's the way it is. If you come in from outside and your hands are freezing cold, and you put them into cool water, and the water feels warm, it feels warm. That's how it feels. Oh no, but I came from outside, so it's probably not really warm. You know, I shouldn't use this to make my tea. This is really not warm. It just feels warm. But what it feels is warm. Now, I understand what's going on here, the relation of Sinai, is that God is giving them a sensory experience which can't be interpreted as being put in touch with the world around them. It can't be interpreted that. Because they saw voices. That's not how you get in touch with sound, and that's not how you get in touch with visions, not by seeing voices. That ain't it. This is something that's totally different, coming from a totally different source. It's a totally different kind of communication. That's what the Torah is telling us. They saw the voices, says to me, number one, they're having an experience totally unlike mine. There's nothing in my life that would tempt me to use those words. That's one thing. Okay, but it's not just that. It's not just, they said, we experienced blah. See, never had blah, right? Okay, so it's different from anything you had. No, it's different from that. It's words that describe something which are not a way of putting us in contact with our world around us. Because if I'm going to have contact with voices, it's through hearing. If I'm going to have contact with the world through vision, it's going to be colors and shapes, things like that. So here, I think, are words that tell us they had an experience which for them had to be interpreted as not of something in our world, but something which transcends our world. And that's how they could have that's how God could communicate to them this truth that he transcends the world in a way that everybody could appreciate it, not just the philosophers. And then it becomes a staple of Jewish belief and understanding that God transcends the world. Yeah.
I agree completely, but I want to add something that nowadays I think we can't see the voices. I mean, all you need is the proper receiver to registrate the frequency of the sound.
I would put that on a par with looking at printed music. Are you seeing the symphony?
You can hear and see it simultaneously.
That's something else entirely. That means I hear with my ears and I see with my eyes. That's no problem. That's usually what's going on, isn't it? I'm talking to you. You hear me and see me simultaneously. That's not strange. That's not surprising. Yeah.
There are some meditative techniques that if one works on it, that say that you can actually achieve the level where you actually are seeing. If you listen to something, you can actually see sights. It's not that you're seeing a representation.
You see what?
You see things. It's not something that you've seen before. That's how they say that. It's not a representation. It's not like you see a mountain when you hear a trumpet. It's more that you see something you've never seen before.
Well,
and
I went to Switzerland this summer and I saw things I've never seen before.
Right, but
this is where you're just sitting in a room.
If I close my eyes and I press my eyeball, I get like a cascade of colors that I've never seen before.
But it's actually you're seeing sound. I don't know what that means.
I mean, there are no colors there? So it's not red, blue, or green?
I've never experienced it, so I honestly can't.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So I know that it's in plenty of sources that I've seen from a variety of different sources that I've seen.
I'm suspicious that the words that are being communicated to you and me are not really the words that we're talking about now. When somebody says something to you and the words he uses are to you patently absurd, the first thing you ask is maybe means something different by the words that he's using. I want to know from these people whether their visual experience has no color, no shape, no form. If they will, in the end, say, "Oh yes, of course, it was red, green, and blue," then I know that's not doesn't mean what I'm talking about now in this particular shift. For example, which notes did they see? A B flat, G sharp. You know, which register? Is that the way they're going to describe the visual experience? It was a saxophone B flat. That's the illusion of the true experience.
I doubt it very much. I don't know. I've never actually experienced it. But that's...
My guess is that these people here probably didn't write it in English. There were some other languages being translated into English.
A lot of them,
yeah. I'm suspicious that what the words that you're reading probably don't mean what we're talking about today.
Okay, and also that means that the vision that they saw was not, it's not that they saw, let's say when they heard Hashem say one word, they saw green wavy lines.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That would be
synesthesia. Right, it wasn't
color, shape, form, anything. It was vision of something that we have absolutely no clue.
That's right. That's why we can't make sense of it. That's why we can't make sense of it. And by the way, when you come across descriptions which are, to us, absurd descriptions that don't communicate because they're, like, contradictory, I think this is the right attitude to take towards them. Well, these words don't say anything to me, because my language and my life, they don't communicate, they don't talk. And as serious people use these words, then what I have to say is, they're describing something that's totally beyond my world. There's a session in the Gemara which may mean that 10 plus 10 plus 10 is 20. Something like that. They measured something and it didn't take up any space, you know, the arm didn't take any space, because when you measured from this wall of the arm and this wall of the arm to the walls, so you got a certain number, like you get 10 plus 10 plus the length of the arm. And when you measured the walls, you got 20. So the arm just didn't take up any space. Now, maybe you can read those words differently, but if you take them the way some want to take them, so when I read them, I have to say, they don't talk to me. The words just don't talk to me. You know, you can't tell me that 10 plus 10 plus 10 is 20. You know, in my mathematics, it doesn't work. And if you tell me, I'm telling you that 10 plus 10 plus 10 is 20, then I say, you know, I hear the sound waves, but they don't communicate any concept to my mind. And if you're a serious person and you insist on using those words, so what I say is a breakdown of communication here. I don't know what you're talking about. Since you're a serious person, I have to admit that there must be something that this is describing, but I haven't got a clue what it is. To me, it's just like saying, guess what I got in the market today? I got a square circle. Yeah, did you? That's interesting. But I didn't say it doesn't talk to me. No concept is formed in my mind. There's nothing, you know, I'm not going to ask you, you know, will it fit in this box or that box? Because if it's a square circle, that won't fix in any of my boxes. You know, it's not relevant to my box. So, yeah.
What I meant by saying this, that we have nowadays this ability to see the sounds, I meant, for example, the effect of ultrasound. When you women go to see the, you don't hear it, but you see.
What you see is a picture.
It's a reflection.
What you see are. But that's something else entirely. A person that doesn't know ultrasounds are. And you show him this picture, he'll say, well, that's a very blurry picture of a penis. Don't know how you got your camera in there, you know, but what you're seeing is a picture. You're seeing colors and shapes, of course. You just mean that it's caused by certain sounds. Like, sure, that's quite true. What you're seeing is a picture, right? Yeah.
I just want to understand, because it seems like what he's saying is different. You're saying that the actual, what they saw had no bearing on reality? What they saw had no sounds, no...
They saw has no bearing on reality, little r. It has bearing on reality, capital R. In other words, God is sending a message here in an experience that when you interact with me, it's utterly different from everything else. How can you communicate that? By giving them an experience which for them is not an experience that puts them in contact with this. Or with saxophones. Or with the northern lights, you know. The sensation of flying. Or it's just not that. It's not that.
Because what he seems to be saying is that it's basically just like a metaphor. That they call the visualization of speech. This means that the prophetic vision is not actually a depiction of the glory. It's not saying that it's a literal picture of God. Just saying that you conceive it from the power of speech. So he's gonna tell you something, and just like the prophetic lens, just like the lens, he's gonna tell you something, and then you're gonna see something. Through that.
You're right. I'm not talking about what he's referring to here. He didn't mention what I'm talking about now.
Oh,
I'm talking about something else, which is the particular prophecy that the entire people had at Sinai, which had a different purpose. I'm just saying that this is another aspect of things over here. When he says the visualization of speech, he's not talking about what I'm talking about. Hmm. I'm talking about the statement in the Torah which says all the people saw the voices. And he doesn't bring that verse here. And so I'm just mentioning.
I think that's what he was talking about.
No, no. Visualization of speech is not a verse at all. And this is more on the Hebrew side, it's from the Sifri, which is from the Midrash.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a verse at all.
And this is that very experience that overwhelmed them and they kind of lost consciousness?
I don't know, because it says the whole people saw the voice says. That could be kolos in Hebrew. The kolos could be the kolos of the shofar that they heard and the sound of the thunder and so on and so on. But it speaks about seeing those voices.
And that implies that they did not hear these voices. They only saw these voices.
No, why should it imply that? Why can't they both hear it and see? I don't see why.
Because if they could still hear these voices,
yeah.
Their vision of their voices could be a product of their...
No, that doesn't follow.
Would work along with
that doesn't follow. Oh, you have to go back to Aristotle to appreciate this. It's a fascinating thing. This book is rectangular, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know that because I look at it. If I close my eyes and feel it for the first time, I can feel straight line. Hmm. Right. Right angle. Sure, that's a right angle. I'm used to those. Straight line. Whoops. Another right angle.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. Another straight line coming back. This one was going up. This one's coming back. Straight. Yes, definitely straight. Another angle. I'll bet when I go along, I'm going to come to the first one. Watch, because I know what rectangle is. Why fast am I? Whoops, there it is, to the right hand. And there's the first one again. That's a rectangle! My hands told me so. Now, Aristotle had a whole tizzy about this. How can you see rectangles and feel rectangles and it be the same rectangle? You know, sight gives you visions. Touch gives you feelings. What has the vision got to do with the feeling? How does it get, you know, sort of tucked together into the same thing? So he had a thing called the common sensorium, which was the same thing he invented to explain how it is that the touch and the vision could be about the same thing. Otherwise, why is it the same thing?
There should be simultaneous.
In modern times, we said, no, it doesn't have to be simultaneous at all. Not at all.
I guess there should be some integration between ourselves.
Okay, so he had to invent a psychological capacity called the common sensorium, where all these things are tucked together so they can come together. We and Hume talked about association of ideas. You have this one and that, they have them enough, so you associate, your mind goes intuitively back and forth from one to the other. But it's just something that has to be accounted for, that the squareness of the book, the rectangularity of the book, is something which is available. The very same property, the very same characteristic, the rectangularity of the book is available to both the eyes and the fingers. That's not pushes, you know, that's not obvious, that's not trivial. Somehow you got to get one or the other. Indeed, Richard Gregory writes, and there have been a number of cases like this. What about people who are blind? This was a question I think Locke first asked. Imagine a person who's blind, becomes an adult, and he has learnt about squares from touch. Now, imagine his sight restored. And he's now shown visual objects. Will he, by sight alone, be able to tell which things are squares? So this is a way of testing. If the empiricists are right, the answer has to be no. Because they say you only learn that visual squares and tactile squares are related through experience. You experience the one or the other so many times and you learn. Otherwise you wouldn't do that. And as a matter of fact, in the cases that are on record, they typically don't know. They typically don't know. They have to be taught which they are. You say, but look, what you learned is it's got four pointy angles. So when he sees it, can he see that it's not a circle? Can he see that it's got, you know, irregularities? The answer is no.
You only learn pointy by sight. You only learn what pointy means.
They learn it quickly. They learn it very quickly, but no.
Rabbi, what happens, let's say someone is blind, and basically someone describes them, like, what the Statue of Liberty would look like. Their sight got restored. They were taken to the Statue of Liberty. They would know it by sight, because they've heard of what it looks like.
Imagine a person is blind from birth, right? Now, you say to him, I'm thinking of something that's red. I imagine that word isn't going to say much to him. That's the problem here. The problem is that the vision words aren't going to speak to him. So if you describe how it looks,
that's going to be Chinese to me, you know, which just babble, 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 babble. It doesn't say anything to me. Only later, after he has the experience, can the words mean something to him, because the words are attached to the experience that he has.
He describes earlier, it has a big toe.
And how do you know how big looks? How do you know how big looks? Big he knows from touching. He can tell you the bigger little touches, bigger little feelings, but, you know, things felt, but how's it going to attach to things that fill up his visual field? Remember that when the cup gets closer and closer to you and takes up more and more of your visual field, it isn't getting bigger and bigger, is it? No. So a thing being big doesn't mean it takes up a lot of your visual field. You can stand far from the Empire State Building, and it doesn't mean it got smaller. Object constancy. Sorry to break your heart, but you know that's how the real world works. It's perception and object constancy and perception is a big deal. Figure out how that. Okay. Like a Calvin and Hobbes.